Okay, good morning, everyone. I have, as always, I have a lot of material, more material than I'm going to fit in an hour, so I really want to get started on time. My name is Richard Banfield, and I come to you from the Home Office in Progress. And today I'm going to talk to you about what's new in the OpenEdge database. The title out there said version 11. This is not just version 11. We're going to include some things that were put into 10 as well, and I'll talk about that as we go through. So we work with a parallel development paradigm here, so we're still putting stuff into 10 that then gets into 11. 11 had already got released, so there's some things that went into the end of our 10 release that actually didn't get into 11.0. They might have come out in 11.1 or 11.2. So as I go through this presentation, I will try and be specific about exactly which releases each one of these features went into. And this is not a deep dive into each feature. Please feel free to ask me any relevant questions as we go through this, because I think it's better to discuss it as we go through as opposed to at the end. But it's not a deep dive. I have a presentation on each one of these subjects that I'm going to cover. So we're really just going to touch on the surface of each one. So I've broken this up into three different sections. The first section will talk about some of the major features we've done in the last few years. Then I'll talk about some of the really interesting, not so major features that we've done. And then I'm going to talk about some relatively unknown features. And they're relatively unknown. A lot of people do know about them. But then when I wind up working with customers that have no idea about these parameters and tuning opportunities that have been there for years and years and years. So I think that they've just been forgotten about. So I want to highlight some of those as well. So major features. Well, in 10.2b, we released what we call transparent data encryption, or TDE for short. It has three main pillars here, right? It's transparent. It's truly transparent to your application, which is really nice. It makes it really easy for you to adopt encryption in your database if that's something that that you need. It's very, very flexible. It allows you to encrypt data at the individual table level. Also, you can encrypt at the area level of the entire database. You can encrypt your AI data if you want, or your BI data. Depends on how secure you need your system to be. And it's very secure. We have all these, we have a special user now that gets created that's the only one who's allowed to change policies and manage the key store and these types of things for you. So it's highly secure. Realize that because it is so secure, if you lose the key, the encryption key, which I'll talk a little bit about what that is, we can't regenerate that for you, because that's what's used to do your encryption. It's really secure. We can't decode your encrypted data without that key. So make sure you don't lose that key, and I'll talk about that on the next slide. So how does this work? This really encrypts data at rest. Okay, it's not data that's sitting up in memory. It's not data that's going across the wire. If you want to encrypt data that's going across the wire, use our SSL mechanism. Okay. So as your data sits in the database, it'll remain encrypted. As you read data out of the database into shared memory, we decrypt it and then store it in shared memory. This allows us to have full indexing capabilities. If we were to do like encryption at the field level, and that field was part of an index, then the encrypted value, that encrypted value would sort very differently than you would expect A, B, C to sort, right? So we decided not to take that approach. We decided to take this encryption at rest approach and allow everything in shared memory to remain there decrypted. As data then flows out of shared memory back into disk, we read this key store and encrypt the data and store it out on disk. Now, this key store, you know, we have all these industry standard ciphers that you can decide whether you want to use like an AES or a DES or whatever your company has decided that this is the security level you want, the cipher you want to use. We use industry standard ciphers, and those ciphers are documented and well known how the encryption mechanism works. So everyone can see how the encryption works. What makes it unique to you is a special key that you create, and we use that key feed that key into the algorithm to make it unique to your environment. Now, these keys can be created through a passphrase or just automatically created through a name that you give it. If you do passphrase creation, it might be a little less secure because if someone could guess your passphrase, they could regenerate the key. Okay? But in one case, if you were to lose your key store, your key, then you could regenerate it yourself. So that's a good thing. We do not store the key with the database. They're two separate files, right? And that makes sense because, you know, you don't want to leave the key to the house under the rug, right? Everyone knows where it is, or your password under the keyboard, right? And, you know, you don't do that. You want to keep these things very separate. So we don't store it with the database. We don't back it up as part of our backup. That's really your job. It's a separate thing that you need to do as part of managing your encrypted environment. Also, since the data at rest is encrypted, your backup is also going to be encrypted automatically for you. You can optionally encrypt data when you do a binary dump. If you want, you can encrypt that data as well. We have a very flexible migration strategy for this. So if you enable encryption on an individual table, and it's a really, really large table, you may not want to take the time to say, okay, I'm going to wait until an entire table is encrypted before I move on. So what you can do is enable encryption and then run a utility that over time will encrypt all the blocks associated with that table while the database is still up and running and your apps are all happily executed. And absolutely no application changes. I say absolutely no application changes, and in this case we really mean it. Since we have full index capabilities, there's no indexing worries, there's nothing else you have to worry about, because the applications usually look at data, or almost always look at data in shared memory, which is in a decrypted format. And lots of utilities to support this. Alright, so that was 10.2b. In OpenEdge 11.0, our major feature that we released with that is multi-tenancy. And what multi-tenancy does is give you the ability to maintain groups of users in an individual database as basically separate instances, right? So we really want each group of users connected to this database to seem like they're connecting to different databases, right? One tenant can only see data associated with its tenancy. A different group of users or a different tenant can only see data associated with their tenancy. Our paradigm here is a pure multi-tenant paradigm. So you have the database running a single database on a single server, running one version of the application. So it makes it really easy for you to roll out application changes. You don't have to roll it out across a whole bunch of database instances. You roll out the application change once in this environment, and everyone sees it. Schema changes, the same thing. Everyone shares the same schema definition. Everyone has the same definition of what customer is, right? But they all have different views of customer data. They all have their own individual view of customer data. And this data, I would say, is physically separated. It's physically partitioned by tenant identity. Now, for the most case, the adoption here, very little changes to your application. One thing that we do need to have you do is establish identity. You need to tell us what tenant is executing when they're running their article. Now, a lot of you might have an external authentication server. That's where you would establish your identity through the client principle and hand that through to the database, and then everything else will work. If you're already using our underscore user today, then that'll happen for you automatically. You don't need to worry about it. So here's an example of a very simple find where clause, right? So I'm doing a find where customer equals 2, and I'm tenant 1. And tenant 1 can only see tenant 1's data. So you see he returns user number 2 for tenant 1. Now, tenant number 3 has established his identity as being associated with the tenant number 3. And when he runs that exact same R code, notice he gets a different user number 2. So he's pulling user number 2 out of his part of the database. So what have we done to enhance multi-tenancy in the past few releases? Well, in 11.1, we released what we call resource governors. And there are two of them. There's one on the dash L and the dash N. And what this is meant to do is restrict the amount of resources any individual tenant group can actually acquire. So you want to restrict, let's say, the number of locks an individual tenant can have in the database so that one tenant doesn't run a rogue query and eat up all of the dash L and cause other tenancies pain. Right? So that's what we want to do is restrict that. The same thing with the dash N is the maximum number of users any one tenancy. We also provided in 11.3, we released what you call index rebuild online. So this allows you to rebuild an index for an individual tenant while the database is still up. So, you know, if we didn't have this, you'd have to bring the database down and rebuild the index and bring the database back up. Well, if, you know, Hertz has some corruption in their index, why should RentDirect have database downtime? That doesn't seem right, right? That's not the paradigm that we want with this. So this will allow you to rebuild indexes for Hertz without affecting RentDirect from continuing to run its application. And these are the commands to do it. Since there was some note changes that needed to happen in order for us to support this, you actually have to run this enablement command in order to say that this is something you want. You can run several of these or multiples of these at the same time. Nice. And you get data available for all of them. Now, also in 11.3, we released what we call tenant data recovery. Now, sometimes you might have a tenant that, let's say, by accident, deletes all their customer records. They press the wrong button somewhere. Or they deleted all their orders by accident. Or maybe they just ran month-end processing before the end of the month. Okay? Well, what's your mechanism today to recover that data? Well, usually what you do is you go to backup and you roll forward, right? Well, since this is an individual database, you can't go to backup and roll forward without affecting all the other tenants in the database. You don't want to do that. So what this mechanism allows you to do is recover an individual tenant's data without affecting all the other tenants that are on the same, sharing the same database. This is basically done through a restore of a database and a roll forward of a database and then a data move between the two databases at a tenant level. That's how this is accomplished. And with this, you can specify the transaction size, which is very important because you don't want to do this in one very large transaction on your production machine because you wind up blowing out your AI file, so we have the ability to specify that. All right, so those are the two major features that we've implemented in the past few years. Mike?
So these two, index rebuild by tenant and recovery by tenant, are these available to non-multi-tenant?
So the question is index rebuild and data recovery available to non-multi-tenant tables? And the answer is no.
That's true.
And you can bring it up at the info exchange. That's a question back.
Any thoughts around multi-tenant schema level? Sometimes an individual tenant might say, well, we really need this and to the customer.
Right. So the question is about adding multi-tenant specific schema. And so that has not been our paradigm, our approach. We have looked at ways to do that because we have had some feedback to do that. Currently, we have no scheduled plans to do that. So if it's something that's pressing, have a good business case and certainly bring it up at the info exchange. So let's talk about some not so major features. Those are the really big features, the all-encompassing things that drive the release. But there are a lot of smaller features that we've implemented. One is in 11.3 we released what we call an image list. This allows you to give a list of files or a file that has in it a list of files to roll forward. So you can roll forward a whole bunch of files in one swoop. And one thing that's nice about this is that it avoids that redo phase at the beginning of each AI file that you roll forward. So there's a little performance gain there by doing this. We also added some statistics to kind of give you an idea of how far along you are in your AI file, again, in your roll forward AI file. And allowing the multi-tenant data recovery, we implemented a DB restrict. It's very similar to the op lock, but you'll see us using this mechanism moving forward because it's a lot more flexible. What DB restrict does is allow the data, it locks the database for a particular operation. And based on the operation that it's locked on, it allows other connections to actually look at the database. So let's say you're doing a data move. You might still want to run a DB analysis or something, a read-only operation on that database. Well, restricting the access by DB restrict as opposed to op lock allows you to do that. That's the big difference. Again, I mentioned here that maybe ProStruct ad, you might need to do a ProStruct ad while this is occurring, while the database is in this long. Also in 11.3, we examined and improved, greatly improved the performance of the pause running online backup. So if you run online backup, you know that during the beginning of online backup, the database is in a frozen state until the VI file has been backed up. And after that, then we have this queuing mechanism that allows you to continue changing the database, but backup will continue and finish the backup as if it was a point in time when it started. Okay, so that mechanism allows changes to occur to the database while we're backing it up. But during the backup of the VI file, the database is in a frozen state. We don't allow changes to the database to grow that AI space. Well, if you have a large AI file, and based on the ring, the cluster ring of the data in the VI file, that pause can take a long time. So what we've done is enhance that to only back up the active clusters in the VI file. So if you have a ring of only 4 active clusters, we're only going to back up those 4 clusters. Where in the past, depending on the beginning and end of the ring in the file, we will start backing up from the first active one to the very end. And that's why it was taking a lot longer when you have large VI files. We also added an option. If you want to go back to the old way, you can specify the VI backup all instead of just active. The default is active. In 10.2b06 and 11.2, starting at 11.2, we improved index rebuild. We added a lot of new options to index rebuild. I don't want to go into each one of these individually, but I will say that the two most important things, or the most performant things, are the dash data scan threads, which multi-threads the data scan phase of index rebuild. The first phase, when we're looking at all the records in, for the indexes you're rebuilding, and building the keys and putting it into the temporary sort space. That's what that does, that multi-threads that processing. And the other biggest bang here was the dash TF parameter. And what this allows us to do is use more memory to add those sort keys and then do in-memory sort, as opposed to flushing that data out to disk, the temporary file, and having to read it in and sort it and write it back out. So it eliminates a lot of I/O during during part of the scan phase, which we're writing to memory, and during the sort merge phase. Those are the two biggest things. the standard value here of 1.5 times number of CPUs, obviously if you have many, many CPUs, you need to be pragmatic about the value you're setting here, because you are going to actually spawn that many threads. You don't want to have it so that the threads have contention with each other, because you've got 128 cores or something. But with this, the performance improvement that we've seen is dramatic, right? A database that would take 12 and a half hours to rebuild 4 indexes now only takes 2.5 hours. And I've had customers, after I present this, go back to their room and on their laptop rebuild an index, and they validated the statement. So it's really significant. So we also investigated a lot of the network, giving you more networking control. And what I mean by this is, in the past, you've had, we look at 3 different types of networking control. In the past, you've had the ability to manage the process-based control, right? Which is like your MN, MI, MA, those types of, you know, how many servers can I have, how many connections per server, that type of thing. It's really process-based. The only resource-based control you had was the dash MN, which governed how large have the message buffer. But we added a whole bunch of tuning knobs to improve the resource tuning capabilities that you have. And there were 2 reasons we did this. One was to alleviate excessive system CPU, and I'll talk about where that came from, and to control how much data is actually stuffed into these network message buffers before they're sent. Now, the ability to put more than one record in a network message buffer really only applies to prefetch queries, okay? And what I mean by a prefetch query is a query that does no lock. I have three different examples of prefetch queries. There's tons more, but I think you kind of get the idea. Pre-select or scrolling with no lock. These are typical prefetch queries where the data you're retrieving is no lock, and we can send a whole bunch of records across in one fell swoop to the remote client. If you want to share lock, obviously we need to get that one record, share lock it, and send it back. We're not going to share lock a whole bunch in one fell swoop. So the first parameter that we gave you, and again, 10.2.b.06 and 11.1, is end message wait. This determines how long a server is going to wait for a remote request before polling. So the idea here was to reduce the polling activity on the server. Polling is a very expensive system call for us, very expensive. And what we noticed was in certain deployments, the amount of system CPU was two or three times higher than the amount of user CPU for these servers. And the reason for that is because we were polling so much. Now, this exercise here actually wound up, we thought that it would reduce polling. And sure enough, if you're polling every 10 seconds versus every 2 seconds, you are going to be polling less. The problem is that it has an adverse side effect. The server here, right, is waiting for input from remote customers. If a remote user is waiting for a lock conflict to be resolved, right, where does that happen? That happens over on the server side. Well, the only time that the server is going to know that outstanding lock request was released is in part of this event loop. If it's waiting, sitting on this end message wait, it's not doing this event loop to see if it acquired the record locks that are needed for a remote user, that the remote user is waiting on. So therefore, increasing this value actually can have adverse side effects to your overall performance, even though it improves the polling cost or the system CPU usage. All right, so my suggestion for this is leave it alone. All right, if you see this, leave it alone. Or you can set it down to one, which means we'll poll every second. It might improve how fast remote users get their lock requests. But this is really for an idle server that's only waiting on one remote user. If other remote users came in with other requests, it will service them.
In pre-10.2.b.06, what was the default?
In pre-10.2.b.06, the default value was 2. And so if you leave it alone, you'll have the same behavior. Every 2 seconds, We'll do a poll to see if there's any outstanding requests. We'll also do our event loop that says, do I need a remote user that needs to disconnect? Did I get a lock for a remote user? Conflict resolution. So, and it really only applies to servers that are just sitting there idle, because if other remote requests are coming in, we do the process loop each after each remote request. Another tuning capability we gave you for the network layer is what we call a prefetch priority. And what this does is it defers the poll for requests from other remote users while network buffer is populated with multiple records. All right, so that's a mouthful, right? So what we're doing here, the server, when it has one of these outstanding prefetch queries, says, I'm going to take records, no lock records, and start putting them into the network message buffer for this remote user. All right. But every time it puts one record into the network message buffer, it polls to see if another remote user wants that server to do something. Well, we saw that it takes 10 milliseconds to do a poll. That's pretty quick, but it only takes 10 microseconds. To put a network message, a record from the buffer pool into the network message buffer. That's a 1,001 ratio. So we're spending so much time polling as opposed to taking records and populating that network message buffer. We gave you the ability to tune this. I've seen 100 work best in my tests. I've had some collaboration with other folks in the field. Some say around 50 works best for them. So you might want to just play with that value. But what it's going to do is populate the network message buffer more frequently than polling while it has outstanding prefetch queries. If it doesn't have outstanding prefetch queries, then you're not going to see any difference with this. One of the caveats is watch out for slower response for non-prefetch queries. But the thing is, if we're pulling for 10 milliseconds, we could put 1,000 records into that one network message buffer for the cost of one pull. You can't fit 1,000 records in a network message buffer. You just can't. So I don't think that there'll be any effect. You won't see any effect at all, or adverse effect for other users waiting. Another thing we added was what we call prefetch delay. And according to what's saying, you can imagine that what it's going to do is delay sending the prefetched message to the remote user. Our philosophy is we don't want the remote user to ever have to wait for anything. So when that prefetch query comes in, what the server actually does is take the first record, puts it in the message, and sends it off. Even though the rest of the message buffer is empty, it just sends the first one off. And then it assumes that that remote client's going to be consuming that record, whatever it does with it. I don't know, you know, display it on a screen, do some calculation with the data in it, who knows, right? But it's consuming it. And while it's consuming it, then the server starts putting multiple records in that network message buffer. So what this will allow you to do is delay sending that first message across with only one record in it, populated a lot. Now, for interactive users, maybe there would be a difference if you have a performance difference, if you have a slow network. They might see a whole bunch of records at once as opposed to one record start consuming it. For batch processing, I don't think it's going to be an issue. In theory, enabling this should improve performance. I, in my testing, have not seen it. I think when I talked about this in which country I was in, but someone in the audience said, I absolutely have seen a performance improvement with this. So again, you know, your mileage may vary. And for his case, you know, really what that parameter is going to do, it's going to save you one TCP IO. That's really what it's going to do. And so if you're retrieving, let's say, enough records that will fit in one network message buffer, then setting this means that instead of it costing you two network message buffers, one for the first record and one for the rest of them, you'll get it in one TCP IO. So maybe that's why he sees such a big performance. It's hard for me to say. But that's what I believe is happening. The last network parameter that we provided in 10.2.0.6 and 11.1 is the giving you the ability to determine how many records are stuffed in a network message buffer. Obviously, we can't stuff more records in there than will fit. So we must understand that MM does matter here. Okay. So if you have an average record size of 200 bytes, then in an 8K network message buffer, and then of 8K, you can fit about 40 records per TCP IO. All right, now if your MM is set at 1K, you're only going to be able to fit about 5. Well, our default for this value was 16 records. So at 1K, you're not going to see any difference. Right? At 8K, before we would send 16 records across. Now you could increase this and send 40 records across in one TCP IO. Again, now that we're filling up these network message buffers, if you don't have a clean network, it might cause lots of retries, but I think that's becoming less and less common in the field. So I've seen what this will do is determine how many records get stuffed in. Now, there are two ways to do this. There's one by using the number of records, 16 records, 40 records, right? But of course, you've got different tables with different record sizes. So number of records is kind of a weird metric. So what we also added here was a prefetch factor, which says the percentage full of the network message buffer before it gets sent. And that makes sense because if you want, really what you're trying to do here is control how full these network message buffers are. And for small records, it's going to have a different value than for large records, right? So I think using the factor is better. Or the other thing you can do is just set prefetch number X to 1,000, let's say, and you know you're always going to have a completely full network message buffer. It doesn't affect anything if you have fewer records, and we just populate as much as we can and send it. It doesn't take up more space, any of that type of stuff. So. And the default was 16 in the past.
When you tested this, did
you also change anything at the network level, like using jumbo frames, that sort of thing?
I did not. And so, yeah, the comment here is about, was I using jumbo frames or not? Obviously, based on your MM, you may need to change your values to make sure that the underlying network is doing this in one TCPIO versus multiple. That is a good point, but no, I did not. I'll get into why I can't do that in our environment, but. So another group of enhancements that we gave you recently is in the area of buffering, database buffering. Now, you know, why do we buffer? Because buffering is faster than any type of access to disk. We buffer, we've got lots of buffers sitting in shared memory. There's a lot more than these. These are the ones commonly known. File systems have caches and buffers that they deal with. The down on the controllers, they've all got caches. So we've got caches on top of caches on top of caches, right? It's crazy business. But what we want to do is give you the ability to manage, because obviously you want everything to be as close to where your data access is, right? The user's going to be grabbing data out of here. And so you want as much stuff to be in that cache as possible. And we want to be able to manage that cache as smoothly as possible. So what we've done is give you a bunch of tools, parameters, that type of thing, to manage how smoothly the data is going to be managed in these buffer pools. Not these buffer pools, the shared power share. So let's look at the database buffer pool to get a handle on this. So let's say you want a record, right? So let's say you've looked up the index, you know the row ID of the record you want. And then the client or code, either the ABL or SQL engine, will ask the database to go find a particular row. And what it does is look up a hash. Hash is the value, the table number, and the row ID to find where that record actually exists, the block that this record actually exists in the buffer pool. That's how it works. Pretty straightforward. Well, this buffer pool is a finite space, right? Its memory is not infinite, and the size of this is governed by the dash big B. So since this is a finite space, we believe that you're going to have more data in your database that can actually fit in dash big B. So what we want to do is manage the data that is in the dash big B. We call it like building up a working set, right? The working set is the data that your application accesses more often than not, right? There might be some historical data that you access rarely, but the common data you access all the time, we want that to be resident in this buffer. And so what we do is we have a replacement mechanism that's going to help us keep the most recently used data in memory. All right, that's called the LRU mechanism. The LRU mechanism has it's just a chain of all. It's another chain through the buffer pool, and it has a least recently used buffer end and a most recently used buffer end. And the blocks in there are ordered based on their access paradigm. So this LRU mechanism is a very simple mechanism, and it's a very effective mechanism for determining the working set in the buffer pool. It can be followed by certain things, and I'll talk about those. Actually, I do have a comment here that it is easily followed. It's easily followed by someone doing a table scan on historical data, right? Because that's not part of your application's working set. That's how it's easily followed. But it does maintain a very good working set in memory. The problem with LRU mechanism is that it has a very high housekeeping cost. So, I think 10.1c, we improved access to the buffer pool by taking the buffers and giving each buffer in the buffer pool its own latch, right? So now, contention in the buffer pool is at the buffer level. So you only have contention if you have two different users trying to access the same buffer. However, each time a user accesses the buffer, they move it from wherever they are in the LRU chain to the most recently used end. This chain is a shared resource and it has to be protected. So managing of this LRU chain actually single threads all access to the database. It's highly contentious. It's a really bad bottleneck for us. So that's something we wanted to improve on. So reducing housekeeping costs. How do we go about reducing housekeeping costs? Well, in 10206 and 11.1, we introduced what we call dash LRU skips. And there's also a dash LRU 2 skips, which is the LRU skip value for the alternate buffer pool, if you're using that. And what this does is marry two different algorithms, all right? It uses a least frequently used algorithm and the current least recently used algorithm. It marries the two. So what we're saying is that, you know, if you have a large dash big B, right? Let's say dash big B of a million, then a buffer that's here, most recently used, how long will it take for that buffer actually to be flushed out and made no longer part of the working set? It means you have to access a million different buffers, and as you're accessing them, that buffer is going to start moving down the chain, right? And then eventually get evicted out. So you have to access a million different buffers before ever touching this one again. If you're truly doing that, then is that part of your working set? Probably not, right? You want to increase your dash BB if it is part of your working set. So what we decided to do is that not every access of a buffer needs to move it to the most recently used end. We'll marry it with a frequency count. So because you access a buffer, we're not going to immediately move it to the most recently used end. We're going to wait until it's been accessed so many times, a frequency count. And then when it's accessed that frequency, or that frequently, then we'll move it to MRU end. So there's much, much less contention on this chain, because we're not managing an every database access. So this opens the floodgate to allow much higher concurrency in the buffer. That's what this does. This small numbers can make a big difference. I've heard 100 works well. I saw 50 in someone's presentation this morning. You know, tune that to what you are. You can also change this at runtime, which is really nice. You don't have to, you know, you can do it at database startup, but you don't have to bring the database down and back up again to change this value. You can change it through promos screens. You can also change it at runtime through the VSTs, which is interesting. I'm sorry. Yeah?
That's a good question. Is there any way to set up a list of tables if we want to keep in the buffer? Because we developer know that this is more frequently accessed table.
So the question is there the ability for me to say that I want a table to become more resident in the buffer pool than another table? Well, let me talk about that next. Before you continue, I said a million was just an example. Everyone's deployment is, I heard that someone's running with almost a terabyte, I think is what Dan was telling me, someone's running with a dash. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So the comment here is, why am I saying that LRU skips of 100 is a good value? What is the adverse thing from me setting it to a million, let's say?
Well, 1,000.
Or 1,000, yeah. Whatever. Okay, all right. So the problem can be that a block is part of your working set, and it is recently used, but not as frequently used, okay? So that's, we have to find a balance between the two. So you could actually be accessing something now that you haven't accessed in a while, right? So it's not super frequently used, but now it's being more recently used based on running this part of the application. I don't know, maybe you're in a different part of the application, and you want that to be part of the working set. Well, if your frequency is set too high, then we're not going to put that to the recently used end, and it can actually get paged out of the buffer pool.
I understand.
Oh, okay, so that's the balance.
I understand, but I still think 50 is really small.
Yeah, 50 is really small. You know, even 100 could be considered small. I haven't done enough research to see what the ratio to dash big B versus LRU skips is, but in my testing, I've seen 100 do well. I mean, if you're not seeing contention on the LRU latch, then you're really not going to see much benefit.
But
it's at least 100 times better.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Thanks for that. So we also introduced, to help with this buffer, this we introduced a little further back, which is in 10.2b, what we call the alternate buffer pool. And what this allows you to do is set up a second management of buffers in the buffer pool. And what I mean by that is we set up, there's still one, we look at this as one big buffer pool, the gray area here, right? It's one big buffer pool physically, but logically we're gonna break it up into two different sections, two different replacement mechanisms. Access to this big gray area is still through one hash table, just like it was before. There's no difference there, which is really nice. We want to keep the stuff that works stable, right? Less testing needed. So what we did do was introduce an additional LRU chain, a different replacement policy. And what you can do is, if you have tables that you know are very frequently hit, or small tables that you know you want to become resident in memory, state tables, actuary tables, that all parts of your application are touching, then what you can do is take those tables and those objects, not just tables, those objects. So when I say that, the reason why I'm differentiating is because you also want to put your indexes here too, right? So you can take the indexes and the table associated with these things you want to become resident in memory and associate them with the alternate buffer. And then what will happen is they manage a different replacement pool. So you want to size this alternate buffer pool to be large enough to hold everything you want to put in there. If it's sized large enough to hold everything you want to put in there, we don't maintain an LRU at all. There's no need to replace anything if we don't never need to page anything out, right? So it becomes resident. If you put too much data in there and it does start to page, to require paging, only then will we start to manage the LRU, an LRU chain. So that's a way for you to do what you're saying. And so this has a dash B2 parameter, and that'll size the amount of data that we're going to store or manage in this alternate buffer pool. And it is enabled through enable B2, view B2, and to see, you can use view B2 to see all the objects that you've associated with the alternate buffer pool. This can be done through the dictionary as well. You can associate an object with the alternate buffer pool. And there's also an API. We also have a 4GL API you can use if you don't want to. Because I know some people said the interface for the dictionary is cumbersome. So,
is there a way to see how much of the alternate buffer pool you actually are using?
The question is there a way to see how much of the alternate buffer pool you're actually using?
I mean, if you put in 2 gig or whatever, you know, 2 gig for the alternate buffer pool, and you're only using one, well, that one could be put back into the.
We don't maintain a high watermark. There is a buffer used or something like that thing in Promon that, so I think there's a way to correlate off the top of my head. I can't just tell you that, but
you can look at OS reads.
Well, OS reads would tell you whether you're paging there, right? You know how many OS reads you had in?
If you read all the data that's assigned there,
yeah.
The OS reads, that'll tell you how much data that is.
Yeah, so a way to do it is to monitor the OS reads that are in that, but anyway, so we can talk about that offline. There must be a way to correlate it, but I just don't have a top of my head.
Can you talk about 40 gigs of the buffer pool? Okay, so, you know, if you're running multi-tenancy, you know, you could have impact on the tenants if one other five tenants.
Okay, so I'll take that as, is there any thought of having a multi-tenant alternate buffer pool? And so certainly multi-tenants can be put into the alternate buffer pool, but as soon as we introduce the alternate buffer pool, everyone asks, well, can I have more than one alternate? Can I have a B3, a B4, a B5, and then I can put tenant one here, tenant two there, tenant three there. We currently have no plans to do that. And one of the main reasons for that is the LRU skip enhancement has really taken away the contention that we see in the buffer pool. So. I believe that's one of the reasons why we're not going to go down that path.
So you're leading right to my question I was waiting for. Have you benchmarked to see if LRU skips is equal to the alternate buffer pool?
I benchmarked to see if LRU skips is equal to the alternate buffer pool.
Yes.
No, I haven't. And it absolutely cannot be, right? Because if you're not maintaining an LRU chain, it has to be faster than maintaining it every 100 hits.
In theory, but I'd like to see it in practice.
The value, I think
I give you some input on
that. I love that, yes.
In practice, I have a customer with a very large database that was getting a lot of data from B2. When we implemented LRU skip, we moved everything back into the main buffer pool, and they can't tell the difference.
Yeah, and it's really simple to manage. So Tom's comment is that with LRDC, if he doesn't, he doesn't even use the alternate buffer pool. It's such a nice feature. It's extremely easy and, you know, brain dead to use. So I was going to go that path. I'm going to have to speed up here a little bit. The other thing we did, remember we said that this LRU chain can be easily followed? It's easily followed by people doing table scans on historical data. That's one way that it can be followed, easily followed. So we provided a, and this is kind of goes in the little known or unused category, or little used category. We implemented what we call read-only private buffers. And this allows you to have replacement chains per user. So if a user is accessing historical data, they'll have a list of buffers that they'll use to replace, as opposed to using the one in the general or alternate buffer pool. So I have a really old piece of data here. I need to page in a new piece of data into the buffer pool. Well, instead of paging out this guy, what I'm going to do is page out the one on my private replacement chain. So then I'm only affecting myself here. I call this a selfless act. It's not going to make that query run any faster. Matter of fact, it'll probably run slower. But for the health of the overall system, this prevents that fouling of the LRU. And this can be, the default is 0, max 64 per client. This can be set at connection time or at run time through the My Connection BST.
Can I comment on that for a second?
Yeah, real quick, because I'm running out of time.
Very useful for online backup.
So the statement here is that it's very useful for online backup or DB analysis, all those types of things that do these massive reads for the database. Very good point. So tuning suggestions, I've kind of already mentioned all this. So this is a summary of the Dashboard B. In the interest of time, I'll move on. Everyone has access to these slides after the conference. Tom will make sure that they're available for you all. Auditing, right? Auditing, we released auditing in 10.1a. So here's a really nice, flexible way for you to do change capture for things that are happening in your database. You can do it at the object level, at the table level, field level, and you can record just the before and after changes. It's a very, very flexible mechanism. Well, what have we done for you lately in this area? We had some customers that decided they were going to audit everything, and then they realized that that was a little too much. But the storage area that was holding this audit data grew tremendously. And there was no way, even though they archived all the data, there was no way for them to reclaim that space. This facility gives you the ability to reconfigure where the audit data lies and allows you to reclaim the space that's taking up in the audit area. Now realize that this is going to basically drop the old audit data and create the location for new audit data in a new location. So all old audit data is removed, so make sure that you have archived that off before you run this again. Open edge replication, we all know what open edge replication is, a way for us to maintain a hot standby or refer to near hot standby to other database. Very easy, flexible to implement and use. I think we released this in V9 something. It's been out there forever. Also gives the ability to run queries on your hub standby database, so you're not affecting your performance of your production database for running these expensive reports. Well, what have we done in this area for you lately? In 10.2b08 and 11.2, we rolled out the ability for you to increase the value of dash pica. Pica is just this buffering mechanism that maintains a list of buffers or AI buffers that need to be copied to the remote system. And when that would fill up, if the remote system, the target of the replication, isn't keeping up, then that would slow down or even stop production on the production machine. It's not something you want to have happen. But it happens because the target's not keeping up, either because of network latency or because the target's not sized large enough. There's lots of reasons why that could happen. So what we did was we increased the maximum size of 512 to 1,000,000. Realize that if you have 1,000,000 buffers backed up, that means that that hot standby you have is actually 1,000,000 buffers behind. So that's actually 1,000,000 AI buffers behind. Many, many change nodes actually in those 1,000,000 buffers. So just realize that that's what this does.
Have you improved the bilateral with Pika does fill up?
The question is, have we done what happens when pipe of fill does fill up? And no, we have not. We have not. That is on our roadmap and our high availability work that we're looking at doing. Again, no scheduled release for that, but it is something we're investigating. So.
Rich.
I'm sorry.
I think that 1 million is actually 11.3. We have 11.2 and max is 8.2. We've tried to go higher.
Okay, I'm sorry. So the comment is that the belief is this is was released in 11.3. That's possible. I'll double check on that. Thanks for that.
There's a hot fix. There should be a hot fix in 11.2.4. There is.
Okay. So it's not generally available in 11.2. It's only available through hot fix. Okay. And we've also allowed JTA to coexist with replication. So if you're using our SQL product to do heterogeneous updates across multiple databases, you would use the JTA for an external transaction manager. But that did not work with replication because the notes that we need to do to manage that were in a sense the target, and the target would come up and wouldn't honor that. So that was enhanced and allowed now in 11.2.
That also allows you to use OEBPM.
So it also allows you to use OABPM. So any the reason why OABPM, we could say OABPM, we could say Crystal, we could say lots of things. So it's whatever is making changes to the database that's through our SQL product. And as a comment here is that OABPM is one of those things. The changes for index move and in, table move are now also propagated to the target. In a little or relatively known category is this dash ASC, this async parameter. This the default is 10, max is 500. Disabling it, set it at 501. If you have a decent network and you don't worry about concern about acknowledgments requests are coming back from the target, then setting this really high up to 500 or 501 will improve the performance of your replication environment. So now into the relatively unknown or forgotten features. In 10.2.B.04, we released the ability for you to manage the large file attribute of the on the target of a restore. Sometimes you want the target to have the large file enabled based on how the target was set up, or sometimes you want it to be how the backup was taken. So this gives you the flexibility to determine that. By default, the target equals the source on the restore. So this allows you to change that. We also intend to be a little or relatively unknown category. Someone asked me earlier about this when we actually released the statement caching mechanism. This was released in, 10.1c. This gives you the ability to identify the line number and piece of code that was .p that was executing at the time of whenever you're examining it. Very useful for trying to find out who's blowing out your dash L, those types of things. It's very flexible. You can monitor it at the user level, or all new users, all current users, on many different levels. And I will just show this is the flexibility options you have for managing the different types or connections that you want to monitor. And you also have the ability to look at it, look at the data group for a long, and specify a directory for a file that will exist if things overflow in the amount of memory that I think it's up to 256 lines, something like that, before it overflows. This is an example of the of what the a FIFO or a stack will look like. Again, this is line number and procedure names, and the .rs they came from. Realize this line number must, in order to reference this line number back in the code, you have to use the full debug version of your .p. So. Just realize that, because otherwise, if you have include files and all sorts of stuff, things won't match up. Another way to do this, outside of using statement cache, is to do a pro stack or a pro get stack on Windows. This was available in 10.1c. It has more recently been in 10.2b, has been updated to when it produces the file, the ProTrace file, it actually includes the whole ABL stack. So it's another way to see what's going on in ABL. If you want to do it and you don't want to enable statement caching, this is another way to do that. If you are going to use the kill command, make sure that you specify a dash there. because on some machines, some platforms, if you just say kill SIG user one in the PID, it actually sends it a hang-up signal as opposed to accepting the stack. So be very careful when you do that. Another relatively forgotten or unused parameter, and believe it or not, is the OM size. Well, when we map data tables to find the storage areas, we have a cache to do the mapping, right? I won't go into this in all the detail, but the cache lookup, right, is through a hash. And when we first bring up the database, we have a primary cache where we load everything into. And whatever fits in that cache will sit there. And because we assume nothing there is changing, we don't have to latch in order to manage that cache. However, if there's an overflow, let's say you've got 2,000 tables, and you only have a size for 1,000 entries in this primary cache, what will happen, a secondary cache gets created. Now, in the secondary cache, this is where we manage all the online schema changes. So if you were to add a table or modify something, add an index, that object now needs to be mapped as well. So that would get put into the secondary cache. Since the secondary cache is a dynamic changing thing, we must latch and manage it. And since it's a finite thing, we also must manage the replacement policy for it. And guess what replacement policy we use? We use an LRU mechanism in order to replace this. So what does that mean? If we're using an LRU mechanism here, it means there's a high housekeeping cost, right? And it makes single access here. So that's something we want to avoid using that LRU mechanism. So what we did was, in the next year I'll show you. First one I said, do I have a problem with this? Well, one way you know you have a problem is if you look at this BST, this latch BST, and if you have latch weights on the OM latch, then you know that you have contention in this mapping area. And there's something very easy you can do to avoid that. To know if you have your OM cache sized properly, you can just do a simple select count star from underscore storage object. That's going to give you the number of objects that exist in your database. Set your OM size when you start your database. Set your OM size to just a little bit above that in case you have any other schema changes. And if you do that, then you'll see that everything is going to fit into that primary cache and you'll have no OM contention, no mapping contention. Is this a common thing? It's very common. I see it at customer sites all the time. People just, I don't know, they just forgot about it. It's been there since 10.1c. So, I'm sorry, since 9.0a. So it's been there forever. People just aren't aware of it. They just forget to set this. Think about every database access. Every time you do a table reference, every time you do an index reference, that OM cache gets looked at. That's a lot of latching that you can avoid by setting this properly. I don't want to go through this slide, but what I want to do is have impact here. This is a slide that shows you all the different algorithms that you can change, you can tune online through various mechanisms, through VSTs or through Promo. I don't know if a lot of people don't know that you can actually do all this tuning while the database is running. You need to bring the database down all the time and restart it in order to do these things. But what I did want to highlight here is the ability to increase certain memory structures while the database is up. And the list that we maintain, that we currently support, this again, this was available first in 10.1c, is the number of after image buffers and before image buffers, the size of your buffer pool, both on primary and secondary, the dash L, right? If you're constantly getting log table overflows, you can increase the size of the dash L at runtime while the database is up. You can also increase that OM size we just talked about. The MTPM size, if you're using multi-tenancy, there's a mapping that gets done at the tenant level that you might want to increase to be at least the size of the number of tenants you have. And the MXS parameter, have you ever got that error saying, you know, out of shared memory, increase MXS? If you ever get that, you can actually change that without having to bring the database back up. There are some restrictions here. This is an increase and not a decrease. Kernel restrictions apply. You can't obviously allocate more memory than the number of segments that you've got set in your kernel and all those types of things. There are also security restrictions. The user who's running this must have permissions to the database, the same permissions as the .db file, because that's what's needed in order to create a new shared memory segment, we create that new shared memory segment with the same permissions as the .pb file. So if things are set up in this way, then now this will run smoothly for you. So with that, I just want to summarize. We went over some of the major enhancements, TDE, multi-tenancy. We talked about a bunch of other enhancements, some runtime tuning you can do, utility performance with the index rebuild that we did and the backup. Gave the ability to have more insights into what the application is doing from a DBA perspective, which is really nice, because you can see that remotely, right, which is really nice. We talked a little bit about auditing, went through a bunch of little or unknown or forgotten features, I like to call them the private buffers, the own cache, and the ability to change a lot of parameters online. So with that, I'm just about up to time. So if you have any questions, maybe you can see me over lunch. And I hope you enjoyed the session.